It's your turn now, kid.
It's your turn now, Marco, here on Astro Talk. You're listening to Astro Talk, CITR's weekly astronomy talk show with your host, Marco.
Good afternoon, this is Marco. Welcome to CITR, and you're listening to Astro Talk. So what are we going to do today? I have an article about a star that grazed our solar system maybe 70,000 years ago, or so scientists say. So if that happened, I thought if it grazed our solar system, then it would send a lot of comets and stuff into the inner solar system. So apparently there was life around at that time, but it still apparently happened. So I'll read about that. A star grazed our solar system 70,000 years ago. So hang on, let me open this. It's not cooperating. So I sent the email to myself, and I'm trying to open the article. So here it is. It's from space.com, and it says, a star grazed our solar system 70,000 years ago, and early humans likely saw it. So some distant objects in our solar system bear the gravitational impact of a small star's close flyby 70,000 years ago, when modern humans were already walking the Earth, a new study suggests. In 2015, a team of researchers announced that a red dwarf called Schultz star apparently grazed the solar system 70,000 years ago, coming closer than one light year to the sun. For perspective, the sun's nearest stellar neighbor these days, Proxima Centauri, lies about 4.2 light years away. So when they're saying it came within one light year, they're saying it grazed our solar system. Well, maybe it really didn't graze it. It didn't rub against it, but came close enough. The astronomers came to the conclusion by measuring the motion and velocity of Schultz's star, which zooms through space with a smaller companion, a brown dwarf or failed star, and extrapolating backward in time. So I thought if a star came close to us, then its gravitational forces would cause havoc. Comets and asteroids would be sent towards the sun, and it's possible planets would be knocked out of alignment. So there could be some pretty serious stuff happening if a star came close to us. So I'll spell it, S-C-H-O-L-Z, Schultz's star passed by the solar system at a time when early humans and Neanderthals shared the Earth. The star likely appeared as a faint reddish light to anyone looking up at the time, researchers with the new study said. And here it has 10 top 10 star mysteries. I'll look at that after I finish this. Be interesting is to look at top 10 star mysteries. It might challenge a person's knowledge of astronomy. So let's see how badly I do on it. Okay, the new study bolsters the 2015 analysis with a different type of evidence. A research team led by Carlos de la Fuente Marcos, I wish I had a name like that, of the Complutense University of Madrid, analyzed 339 known solar systems, bodies with hyperbolic orbits, paths through space that are V-shaped rather than circular or elliptical. Objects on hyperbolic orbits could theoretically have come from interstellar space, just like Oumuamua, the first known solar system visitor born around another star. So Oumuamua came into our solar system or close to it. I think it was an asteroid, cigar-shaped asteroid. So that was last year, I think. But they could also be natives nudged onto weird tracks by gravitational attractions with the sun or some of its planets. And denizens of the Oort cloud, a frigid ring far from the sun that's home to trillions of comets, could even be perturbed by the Milky Way's disk or wandering stars that get too close. So says De La Fuente Marcos in a statement, and quote, using numerical simulations, we have calculated the radiance or positions in the sky from which all these hyperbolic objects seem to come. In principle, one would expect those positions to be evenly distributed in the sky, particularly if these objects if these objects come from the Oort cloud. However, what we find is very different, a statistically significant accumulation of radiance. The pronounced overdensity appears projected in the direction of the constellation of Gemini, which fits the close encounter with Solstice star, end quote. Whatever that means. Okay. Oumuamua is not among the Gemini group, so that bizarre. Needle or cigar-shaped object really does seem to have come from another star system, the researchers added. They also flagged 8 other bodies that may be interstellar interlopers, including comet Ison, so that's ISON, which broke apart during a highly anticipated close pass by the Sun in November 2013. The new study was published online last month in the journal Monthly Notice of the Royal Astronomy Society Letters. You can read it for free at the online print site at xiv.org. So here's an artist's illustration of the red dwarf known as Solstice star, with its brown dwarf companion in the foreground during the pair's flyby of the solar system 70,000 years ago. The sun would appear as the bright star from the pair left background. So that's interesting. A star, they think, grazed their solar system. Grazed means they didn't really touch it. Came within one light year. So interesting stuff, but who knows if it's true. Okay, so let's go to a David Letterman type top 10 star mysteries. For many stargazers, the night sky might look like a backdrop of very similar twinkling lights. But actually, the billions of stars that make up the universe are varied and full of tantalizing marvels. From stellar fireworks caused by supernova explosions to invisible black holes, astronomers are gradually figuring out how stars work and what makes each variety unique. Okay, so diamonds in the sky. That's our next mystery, but it's not saying anything. So when a star the mass of the sun uses up its nuclear fuel, it expels most of its outer layers to leave just a very hot core called a white dwarf. Scientists had speculated that the bottom of a white dwarf's 31-mile or 50-kilometer thick crust was crystallized carbon and oxygen, similar to a diamond. So that's what I heard before. If you want diamonds, go to a white dwarf. It might take you a lot of time and money to get there, but you'll have a big diamond. And in 2004, they found that a white dwarf near the constellation Centaurus, BPM 37093, was made of crystallized carbon weighing 5 million trillion trillion pounds. In diamond speak, that's 10 billion trillion trillion carats. Interesting. Okay, stellar corpses. What does it say about stellar corpses? Magnetars are dense neutron stars, a type of stellar corpse with magnetic fields billions of times stronger than any magnet on Earth. They release flashes of X-rays about every 10 seconds with an occasional gamma ray burst. They weren't classified as a distinct star type until 1998, nearly 2 decades after their telltale light shows were first spotted. In March 1979, 9 spacecraft observed a release of radiation equal to the amount of energy the sun lets off in 1,000 years, coming from the location of a supernova remnant called N49. Now let's look at star. It says close quarters. It has a picture of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 or up to 10 stars that are very close to each other. What does it say? Close quarters. Stellar clusters are composed of many stars that develop at the same time. Some contain several dozen stars and others millions of stars. Some star clusters can be seen with the naked eye, such as the famous Pleiades cluster in the constellation Taurus. Stars form in the same region, but why some stay together forming clusters is a mystery. So I think that what happened to our Earth, it formed in a cluster and then it ran away. It wanted to be in its own. So basically, it's not in the cluster anymore. So I believe all stars form in clusters. So it wasn't just one star that forms in a cluster. I think apparently that the stars form in clusters. Okay, so what I'm going to do, if the computer, there, it's going to cooperate with me. So I am going to go to a break, and we're going to listen to an angry listener. So this is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
We just played Velvet Dinosaurs and their latest hit, Eating the Plate. Now let's go to the phones and hear what you have to say. Go ahead, caller, you're on the line.
Master Dirty Red Scum!
Really?
Kill!
That's really
kill! Bad. Kill! Filthy bastard Tommy! I hate him! I hate
him! Well,
You know, maybe you should relax a little bit. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Soundtrack to your life, perhaps a song from a film or a tune from TV. My name is Gap. Exploding Head Movies is here to give you sounds from the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future, and those forgotten classics that need a little rescue.
Yeah. Come on, baby. Come on. I won't let you down. Follow me.
Exploding Head Movies, Monday, 7 to 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. I like that guy's voice of the Exploding Head movie. And one time I saw him and I heard his voice and I was blown away. So, Exploding Head Movies. There we go. Okay, I just want to digress a bit and go to something called Tech Breakthrough Could Transform the Electric Car Market. I think it's about lithium. So the electric car revolution is driving a lithium iron battery boom that could be worth $67 billion by 2022, as long as the supply crunch doesn't choke it to death. Supply crunch, yes, we're running out of our ores, our materials. And asteroids, comets, or even the moon could be the solution to that. So that's why it's not a waste of money to go up into space and find out these things. So back to the article. Thankfully, International Battery Metals Limited is seeking to revolutionize the economics of lithium extraction. Extraction. There we go. Traditional solar evaporation technology takes up to 24 months to extract lithium from heavy metal brine. IBAT's incoming CEO, John Burba, says he can do it in 24 hours. Not only that, traditional methods only recover 40% of the resource. With their new tech, IBAT, which is International Battery Metals Limited, can achieve lithium extraction rates up to 90%. Elon Musk even offered $325 million to acquire the CEO's previous company, which owned the technology underlying IBAT's technology. New York Global Investment Bank, Jefferies, valued the same company at seven times that number, at $2.5 billion. Fortunately for investors, the deal was never completed. That's why we're so interested in the international battery metal story. Here are five reasons why you should be paying attention. Oh, so we have a top five here, not a top ten. Number one, the coming lithium mega boom. Number two, game-changing extraction technology. Number three, an $84 billion partnership opportunity. Number four, massive interest from Tesla Motors. Number five, a veteran team of lithium pioneers. So that we have is the lithium story. So let's get back to our top 10 star stories. I think we're on number four, Stellar Rumbles. It's got a nice picture, and what does it say? Stellar Rumbles. A star quake is thought to be tearing apart. It's thought to be the tearing apart of the surface of a neutron star, much like an earthquake here on Earth, but probably a lot more energy released. In 1999, astronomers identified these bursts as a cause of gamma rays and X-rays coming from neutron stars. Predicting these powerful bursts has remained a mystery. Recently, John Middleditch of Los Alamos Natural Laboratory and his team found that for a particular type of spinning neutron star called a pulsar, the time to the next quake is proportional to the size of the last quake. So these are top 10 star facts. Number five, superstars. Let's read about superstars. A neutron star is born out of a supernova explosion, which compresses the star's dying core with a mass greater than the sun's into a ball with a diameter the size of a small city. One step from becoming black holes, neutron stars are the densest objects in the universe. Just a teaspoon would weigh roughly a billion tons on Earth. So I believe that a teaspoon of a neutron star weighs something like all of Mount Everest, so that's pretty heavy. In 2005, NASA scientists found the source of gamma ray bursts that emit as much light as 100,000 trillion suns and solved a 35-year mystery. When two neutron stars collided at speeds tens of thousands of miles per second, they emit gamma ray fireworks. I bet they do. Okay, now let's look at starbursts. What's a starburst? I guess that's number five or six in our list of 10. A new class of stars called rotating radio transients, or RRATs, rats, can be fickle flashers. They are massively compressed neutron stars that intermittently send out bursts of radio waves that can last for as few as 2 milliseconds, with dark gaps lasting as long as 3 hours. Not only are these outbursts short-lived, in order to detect rats, astronomers must distinguish the fleeting radio flashes from terrestrial radio interference. Even so, there could be hundreds of thousands of them in the Milky Way. So I remember I was reading a story or listening to a program, and they were talking about the Milky Way and the after effect of the Milky Way called the cosmic microwave background. And apparently, if we tune our radio and we get that fuzz, you know, that static, and our years ago when we had TVs and we would get static, that was just the aftermath of the Big Bang showing up on our TV sets or showing up on our radios. And apparently also, from the aftermath of the Big Bang, there's microwaves floating around. So you know what a microwave oven does? It cooks things. So we are being cooked by the Big Bang as we speak. I think it's a very slow rate, and I don't think it's going to kill us, but we are being cooked, so we're in a microwave, believe it or not. Okay, let's go to the next star mystery. This is called a singles club. What's a singles club? Okay, stars may not be loners, as once thought. Now, astronomers predict that 85% of stars in the Milky Way galaxy reside in multiple star systems. More than half of all stars are binary stars, are two stars that are bound by their mutual gravitational attraction, with each star orbiting around the center of mass. When three or more stars huddle together, it's called a multiple star system. In 2005, astronomers presented evidence for the first planet orbiting a binary system. Number, I think, 7 or 8 on our list of 10, enigmatic explosions. What's an enigmatic explosions? Good. The catastrophic explosion of a star sends out shock waves that radiate outward at 22 million miles per hour. The end of life for some stars can be a spectacular event called a supernova. When a star that's more than 8 times the mass of our sun burns out, gravity's inward push tears apart the star's innards. The explosion propels jets of high-energy light and matter out into space. Since Johannes Kepler's supernova was spotted in 1604, astronomers haven't witnessed one in our own galaxy. So that's strange, because I thought the general rule was, and this is general rule, of course, that there's one supernova explosion per galaxy per 100 years. So it's been 400 years, over 400 years, since we spotted our last supernova in our Milky Way. So we are long overdue. Okay, number 8 or 9 on our list called sun rays. The sun's atmosphere or corona can reach a bubbling 3.6 million degrees Fahrenheit or 2 million degrees Celsius and can unpredictably fling out streams of high-energy particles at near light speed. Called solar flares, these bundles of charged particles accelerate along curved magnetic field lines towards Earth, where they can disrupt communications and satellite technology, electronic devices, and even cell phones. The largest solar flares can release millions of hydrogen bombs worth of energy, or enough energy to power the United States for 100,000 years, if it could be harnessed. Astronomers are just beginning to understand the inner workings of the sun, with a goal of predicting these fierce flares. I think this is number 10 now, Grim Reapers. Number 10 on our list of 10 star mysteries. What's a Grim Reaper? Well, a Grim Reaper is black hole. Grim Reapers is the title. I shouldn't read Grim Reapers. Black holes are so dense that nothing can escape from their gravitational clutches, not even light. Once past the event horizon or the boundary beyond which even light cannot escape, there's no way out. Now astronomers have strong evidence for the existence of stellar black holes, which form from the collapse of massive stars, as well as supermassive black holes that reach jaw-dropping weights of millions of solar masses. Well, all these, this was not any surprise, so I'm not sure why I read this. A lot of this stuff was not a surprise. So, let's go. Oh, I have to update the listeners. I keep trying to contact Trina Ray. I interviewed her a couple years ago. She was working on the Cassini mission, and she gave a wonderful interview. I thank her very much. Thank you, Trina. And now that the Cassini mission's finished last September, it crash-landed into Saturn. I keep trying to contact her, and I'm not having much luck. So she answered me, and I hope she answers me soon, and I can get her back on. And my goal is to put Ed Stone on the mic if I could. And there's an astronomer. I don't remember it now, but she broke the U.S. record. She spent 665 days in space. So I hope to be interviewing some interesting NASA people. And when I get them on, we'll have fun listening to what they say. Okay, I'm going to go for a break now. And when I get back, we're going to talk, we're going to talk about astronomy. Okay, so I'm going to go for a break. So you're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
Metal Radio, bringing you the best metal for over 30 years on CITR. Tune in every Saturday from 1 to 3.
We just played Velvet Dinosaurs and their latest hit, Eating the Plate. Now, let's go to the phones and hear what you have to say. Go ahead, caller, you're on the line.
Master Dirty Red Scum!
Really?
Kill!
That's really
kill! Wrong. Kill! Filthy bastard Tommy! I hate him! I hate him!
Okay, well,
You know, maybe you should relax a little bit. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Welcome back. This is Marco on Astro Talk. You know what? I really like that. I like that angry listener. Guess what? Let's just listen to him once again.
We just played Velvet Dinosaurs and their latest hit, Eating the Plate. Now let's go to the phones and hear what you have to say. Go ahead, caller, you're on the line.
Master Dirty Red Scum!
Really?
Kill!
That's really
kill! Wrong. Kill! Filthy bastard Tommy! I hate him! I hate
okay,
him!
Well,
You know, maybe you should relax a little bit. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Well, there we had it, the angry listener again. I love that angry listener. He's pretty cool. And sometimes good to clear your head, isn't it? Listen to some metal or listen to the angry listener, go nuts, and clears our heads. Okay, let's get back to an article. It's about a star that apparently grazed our solar system 70,000 years ago. So what astronomers mean when they say graze is came within one light year of our solar system or our star. So they did this by tracing the trajectory of parabolas of certain stars in the neighborhood, and they extrapolated back and they said, well, this star probably grazed our solar system. So it's a red dwarf star known as Schultz's star, and its companion is a brown dwarf star, and the pair flew by the solar system 70,000 years ago. Now, this and that, interesting. Okay. I finished that article. Wow. Isn't it crazy? I need the angry listener to scream at me again so I can get my head straight. Okay, so now what are we going to do? Let's go to Hubble. Hubble's always a savior. It saves people when they have nothing to talk about. Guess what? You're going to talk about Hubble. And so let's talk about Hubble solves a cosmic whodunit with interstellar forensics. Before we go on, I just want to mention something. I heard some hockey announcer on some broadcast say that guy went around that goalie and beat him like a rented mule. So I want to say rented mule. So there we go, rented mule. So what's the significance of rented mule? Okay, if a supernova exploded pretty close to us, we'd be beat up like a rented mule. We'd be killed. So I guess that's what it means, a rented mule. That's a good one, isn't it? Okay, so I said it. I got it off my chest. Now I'm going to go on and talk about Hubble. So Hubble solves cosmic whodunit with interstellar forensics. This is on March 22nd, 2018 on www.nasa.gov. So it's a fairly recent article. Guess what? It's an article from today. Okay, and it's got a nice picture, and let's see what it says in the picture. Okay, on the outskirts of our galaxy, a cosmic tug-of-war is unfolding, and only NASA's Hubble Space Telescope can see who's winning. The players are two dwarf galaxies, the Large Magellanic Cloud and the Small Magellanic Cloud, both of which orbit our own Milky Way galaxy. But as they go around the Milky Way, they are also orbiting each other. Each one tugs at the other, and one of them has pulled out a huge cloud of gas from its companion. So what's happening is they are orbiting each other. They're in a tug of war. They're beating each other up. And as they're orbiting, our Milky Way is beating them up too. So it's tearing them apart, and possibly they can merge in the near future with our Milky Way. But there's all kinds of streams of light shown from there, all these rays and dust clouds and stars being ripped apart. Guess what? The large and small Magellanic clouds are being beaten up like a rented mule by the Milky Way. See, I got it. There was a purpose in saying rented mule. So the Milky Way is beating these galaxies up like they are rented mules. I believe they're about 160 and 180,000 light years from our galaxy. They're dwarf galaxies in the local group, and they're being munched on, chewed up by our Milky Way, ripped apart like a rented mule. There, I saw it again. I said it again. Okay, so now here's a photo, and it says Hubble measures content of the leading arm of the Magellanic Stream. The large and small Magellanic clouds gravitationally tug at each other, and one of them has pulled a huge amount of gas from its companion. So this is a caption below a picture. This shredded and fragmented gas, called the leading arm, is being developed by the Milky Way and is feeding new star birth in our galaxy. Using Hubble data, scientists have now solved which dwarf galaxy is doing the pulling. Well, tell us then. Okay, please tell us. We want to see who's beating who like a rented mule. So there's a large stream of gas and they're being ripped apart. Isn't that ugly? It's an ugly scenario. Okay, so back to the article. Called the leading arm, this arching collection of gas connects the Magellanic clouds to the Milky Way. Roughly half the size of our galaxy, this structure is thought to be about 1 or 2 billion years old. Its name comes from the fact that it's leading the motion of the Magellanic clouds. So it's called the leading arm. That sounds like a TV show. The leading arm. The enormous concentration of gas is being devoured by the Milky Way and feeding new star birth in our galaxy. But which dwarf galaxy is doing the pulling? And whose gas is being feasted upon? So who's goring whose goat? After years of debate, scientists now have the answer to this whodunit mystery. So says lead researcher Andrew Fox of the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, Maryland, and quote, there's been a question, did the gas come from the Large Magellanic Cloud or the Small Magellanic Cloud? At first glance, it looks like it tracks back to the Large Magellanic Cloud. But we've approached that question differently by asking, what is the leading arm made of? Does it have the composition of the Large Magellanic Cloud or the composition of the Small Magellanic Cloud? End quote. Fox's research is a follow-up. Fox's research is a follow-up to his 2013 work, which focused on a trailing feature behind the Large and Small Magellanic Clouds. This gas in this ribbon-like structure, called the Magellanic Stream, was found to come from both dwarf galaxies. Now Fox wondered about his counterpart, the leading arm. Unlike the trailing Magellanic Stream, this tattered and shredded arm has already reached the Milky Way and survived its journey to the galactic disk. So I'm just going to break away from the article a bit. I guess they're called the Magellanic Clouds because Ferdinand Magellan, when he was sailing past Africa, all of a sudden in the southern hemisphere, so the Large and Small Magellanic Clouds can only be seen in the south. And he saw them, and so they were called the Large and Small Magellanic Clouds, two patches of light in the sky. So when I was in Uruguay in Brazil, I tried to see them, and I couldn't. I tried to see them from Indonesia, I couldn't. So it could be, I don't know where to look, or something else. But anyway, the leading arm, back to the article. The leading arm is a real-time example of gas accretion, the process of gas falling onto galaxy. This is very difficult to see in galaxies outside the Milky Way because they are too far away and too faint. As these two galaxies in our backyard, we essentially have a front row seat to view the action, said collaborator Kat Barger of Texas Christian University. In a new kind of forensics, Fox and his team used Hubble's ultraviolet vision to chemically analyze the gas in the leading arm. They observed the light from 7 quasars, the bright cores of active galaxies that reside billions of light years beyond this gas cloud. Using Hubble's cosmic origin spectrograph, the scientists measured how this light filters through the cloud. In particular, they looked for the absorption of ultraviolet light by oxygen and sulfur in the cloud. That's interesting. Let's read that again. In particular, they looked for the absorption of ultraviolet light by oxygen and sulfur in the cloud. So our question is, how do they look for that, and how do they know that? How do they know that oxygen and sulfur are absorbing the ultraviolet light? How do they know that's happening, and how do they know that this is the process that's leading to the leading arm? Okay, I'll read on. It'll give us our answer, hopefully. These are good gauges of how many heavier elements reside in the gas. So there's the answer. The team then compared Hubble's measurements to hydrogen measurements made by the National Science Foundation's Robert C. Byrd Bank Telescope at the Green Bank Observatory in West Virginia, as well as several other radio telescopes. So says Barger, in quote, with a combination of Hubble and Green Bank Telescope observations, we can measure the composition and velocity of the gas to determine which dwarf galaxy is the culprit, end quote. Well, what's the answer then? After much analysis, the team finally had conclusive chemical fingerprints to match the origin of the leading gas iron. Okay, tell us, said Fox, and quote, we found that the gas matches the Small Magellanic Cloud, which makes sense because the big guy would be pulling on the small guy. Doesn't that make sense? That indicates the large Magellanic Cloud is winning the tug of war because it has pulled so much gas out of its smaller neighbor, end quote. Well, that just makes, that's intuitive, isn't it? That makes sense that the big guy would be winning the tug of war against the smaller guy. The answer was possible only because of Hubble's unique ultraviolet capability. Because of the filtering effects of Earth's atmosphere, ultraviolet light cannot be studied from the ground. So says Fox, so explained Fox, quote, Hubble is the only game in town. All the lines of interest, including oxygen and sulfur, are in the ultraviolet. So if you can work in the optical and infrared, you can't see them, end quote. Gas from the leading arm is now crossing the disk of our galaxy. As it crosses, it interacts with the Milky Way's own gas, becoming shredded and fragmented. Hi, Emily. How are you? There's Emily out there egging me on, giving me moral support. Thank you, Emily. This is an important case study of how gas gets into galaxies and fuels starbirth. Astronomers use simulations and try to understand the inflow of gas in other galaxies. But here, the gas is being caught red-handed as it moves across the Milky Way's disk. Sometime in the future, planets and solar systems in our galaxy may be born out of material that used to be part of a Small Magellanic Cloud. It's great how things go, isn't it? As Fox and his team look ahead, they hope to map out the full size of the leading arm, something that is still unknown. So Hubble is a project of international cooperation between NASA and the European Space Agency. NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, manages the telescope. The Space Telescope Science Institute, STSCI, in Baltimore, Maryland, conducts Hubble science operations. STSCI is operated for NASA by the Association of Universities for Research in Astronomy in Washington, D.C. For NASA Hubble's portal, go to www.nasa.gov/Hubble. Okay, so we saw that the Large Magellanic Cloud is treating like the Small Magellanic Cloud like it's a rented meal. It's beating it up. So let's go for a break. Enough of this rented meal stuff. I know you guys are getting tired of hearing me say that, but it's kind of addictive to say that. So anyway, let's go. Let's find a nice something I haven't played yet. Let's go to Yip Yip Aliens. What is Yip Yip Aliens? So thank you for listening. I'm going to go for a break now. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Happy, boing, 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 yip, yip.
Don't you put it in your mouth.
Don't you put it in your mouth.
Don't you stuff it in your face.
Don't stuff it in your face.
Though it might look good to eat.
Though it might look good to eat.
And it might look good to taste.
And it might look good to taste.
You could get sick.
Yuck.
Real quick.
Yuck.
Real sick. Real.
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Don't put it in your mouth. Put it in your ear.
Ick! Don't you put it in your mouth.
Uh-uh.
Till you ask someone you love.
That's right, sis.
If it's okay to eat.
If it's okay to eat.
Like a muffin.
Why, sometimes I'd like to take a peppermint and a switchblade and a Cadillac and throw it all in a fire. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Radio for crazy people and the elderly. Oh yeah.
This is going out to the whole wide west side. Know what I'm saying? Break it down for me. Steady mobbing, rock, rock on. I was just a young boy living in the hub city. Eastside Compton. Back in the days when Ice Cube and Easy had every talking about, boy, you can't.
This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9 on the west side at UBC.
Too short, bumped in every super boat and told us all how to ride for the west coast. My people, you can leave me where you at, throw your gloves in the air and wave them like you just don't care. From LA to the Bay, what you say? All day, every day, any damn day. Take a look around, we got the whole world locked down. No, don't stop, won't stop. That's why I put it down for the west side.
Didn't seem that long ago.
Oh no.
We were still in 40s out the liquor store.
Oh no.
Mama started tripping, so it's time to go.
Out to the park with the locusts.
Everybody broke, smoking roaches.
DJ Quick West the had every claiming he was from the CPT.
Y'all remember?
One time tried to clown. We had to burn this bitch on down.
One time for my was in incarceration.
Place a dime with you for having lots of patience.
Two times for my sisters at the county built.
I got some Westside love for all you ghetto children.
Three times for my that been passed away.
I took some cure for you and pray for better days.
One day everything's gonna be fine. But until that day, my only reply.
Oh, that's me singing. Sorry, I don't have a good voice. That's TQ on the west side. That's a good song. I like that song. So, what are we going to read about next? Let's see. What does NASA.gov have for us? Two astronauts among crew heading to the International Space Station. Is that a good story? Nah, that sucks. Okay, so let's look at TESS. So what's TESS? TESS is a planet hunter, the next generation planet hunter. So let's see what TESS stands for. Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, TESS. Let's have that again. TESS, Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. So let's read about TESS. TESS looks pretty good. Looks like a pretty safe topic to go out on. So it's from www.nasa.gov. It's on March 19, 2018, the article, and it's for Media Advisory M18-045. That's comes right after M18-044, I think. Yes, it does. So the article is called NASA to Discuss NASA to discuss upcoming launch of next Planet Hunter. So here it has a beautiful looking spacecraft called TESS, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. It's a NASA Explorer mission launching in 2018 to study exoplanets or planets orbiting stars outside our solar system. TESS will discover thousands of exoplanets in orbits around the brightest stars in the sky. So it's got a beautiful little picture of TESS with all these solar arrays, these dishes, and these weird-looking things. I don't know what they are. But anyway, I guess that's the telescope part of it. It's going to look for exoplanets. So, Okay, so join NASA at 1 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Wednesday, March 28th, as astrophysics experts discuss the upcoming launch of NASA's next Planet Hunter, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. Reporters can attend the event in person at the James Webb Auditorium at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C., or participate by phone. The briefing will be broadcast live on NASA television and on the NASA's website, or the agency's website, as they say here. Scheduled to launch April 16, TESS is expected to find thousands of planets outside our solar system, known as exoplanets, orbiting the nearest and brightest stars in our cosmic neighborhood. So I guess cosmic neighborhood is the key, I guess, in the Milky Way only. Powerful telescopes like NASA's upcoming James Webb telescope can then further study these exoplanets to search for important characteristics like their atmospheric composition and whether they could support life. The news briefing participants will be Paul Hertz, Director, Astrophysics Division at NASA Headquarters, George Ricker, Test Principal Investigator from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Sarah Sager, a Test Deputy Director of Science, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Jeff Wallison, Test Project Manager, NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, Greenbelt, Maryland. I've always wondered about these astronomers. Here they are. They have these little toys, these spacecraft, these satellites they send into space, and then they control them and they get them to do all kinds of such cool science. What kind of, how did they luck out and get those amazing jobs? Like, we got our mundane lives and they play with little spacecrafts in space. Isn't that amazing? So if you go to this article, www.nasa.gov, it's dated March 19, 2018. It's called NASA to discuss upcoming launch of Next Planet Hunter. If you go to that article, you go down a bit, it's got a nice little video and it says, NASA, the search for new worlds is here. So it is a minute 44. It's on YouTube. So go to it. It's called NASA, the search for new worlds is here. So I can't play it because there's no sound coming out of it. So back to the article. A question and answer session will take place during the event with reporters on site and by phone. Members of the public can also ask questions during the briefing by participating in person or using #AskNASA. To participate by phones, reporters must contact Felisa Cho at 202-358-0257 or felisa.cho@nasa.gov or Claire Saravia at 301-286-1940 or claire.g.deseravia@nasa.gov no later than the morning of March 28. For more information on tests, visit https://www.nasa.gov/test. So more on Felisa Cho. She helped me a couple of years ago. I had an interview set up with a NASA scientist. I believe his name was Dr. James Benford. And what happened, it took 6 months for the interview to come through because Dr. Bedford was busy. We couldn't get our time square. And in the meantime, the 6 months, I had prepared for the interview. And guess what? He changed topics. He changed from one telescope to the other. So I had to prepare again. So Felisa Cho asked me to prepare questions. And she said, so what's the big deal about the WFIRST telescope? So I said it in a stupid way. I said, so what's the big deal? Sounding like I was being condescending, saying, what's the big deal? But so I blew that interview by saying that. I knew I shouldn't have said that, but I did. So how life is so interesting when you're an astronomer, isn't it? You run across all these amazing stories. Oh, that's a good one here. 6 things you didn't know about snow. It's a video. Let's see if it's got any script. No, it doesn't, so I can't play it here. Think 6 things you didn't know about snow. So yeah, maybe I can read the video to you. This is what NASA discovers. Number one, snow covers 30% of the land on Earth. That's interesting. Now it's going to go to number two. Number two, more than 1.2 billion people rely on water from snowpack every year. Interesting. Number three, snow melt is the main source of water for 60 million Americans, about 20% of America. Wow. Never talks about Canada, does it? Number four, since 1967, 1 million square miles of spring snow cover has, it went too fast for me. Number five, 70% of water from the snow-fed San Joaquin River irrigates California's central Simi Valley. Interesting. Number six, NASA's Global Participation Measurement Mission observes falling snow, even at the top of hurricanes. So that's 6 things you guys were dying to hear about snow. So isn't that just the coolest? Now you know 6 more things about snow that you probably didn't know before. Okay, let's go to space station research. What's happening in the space station? I'm going to keep it a secret and spring it on you. Here's the article, dated March 21st, 2018. You ready? Rooting for answers. Simulating G-force to test plant gravity perception in mustard seedlings. So isn't that cool? Some people in NASA are operating millions or billion dollars worth of electronic hardware and spacecrafts in space, and other people are testing mustard seeds. How cruel life is. How can some people can operate spacecraft and other people test mustard seeds in space? Well, Maybe it's interesting. Let's read on and see what it says. Rooting for answers. You get that? Rooting, because it's a plant. They're very clever. Rooting for answers. Simulating G-force to test plant gravity perception and muster seedlings. When plants on Earth search for nutrients and water, what drives their direction? Very simply, gravitational forces helps them find the easiest path to the substance they need to grow and thrive. What happens if gravity is no longer part of the equation? Big question mark. Botanists from Ohio Wesleyan University leverage the microgravity environment of the International Space Station to study root growth behaviors and sensory systems in an investigation known as Gravity Perception Systems, Plant Gravity Perception, PGP. The researchers look for adaptability to microgravity and measure overall sensitivity to simulated gravity for two strains of mustard seedlings, including Arabidopsis thaliana wild type and a starchless genetic variant. Within the wild type, starch acts like a weight falling within the root tips and driving them forward toward the earth. As a lead investigator for plant gravity perception, botanist Chris Wolverton describes investigators' central question, and quote, "We want to know what's the leading amount of gravity plants can detect to cause the falling of heavy starchy bodies in their cells," end quote. The study exposes both strains to incremental amounts of gravity ranging from 4/1000 or 0.0004 G all the way up to 1 G. By comparison, gravitational force experienced on Earth is a constant 1 G. I hope I didn't say Ursh. I meant to say Earth. Why include two types of seedlings? Well, here's the question, or here's the answer. While exact thresholds for starchy strains are poorly understood, response mechanisms for starch genetic variants are even more of a mystery. Okay, that's so cool. Plant gravity perception uses acceleration from the European Modular Cultivation System, EMCS, to simulate gravity. Seedlings are first placed in seed cassettes, then aligned along radial blades for a centrifugal rotor. This lets investigators control the intensity of gravity experienced at any point along the rotational arms, testing hundreds of traction degrees of gravity at a single time through controlled spins. Much like, hang on, I gotta scroll this. This mouse is being mousy. It's not cooperating. Much like the popular rides at carnivals that spins riders and causes them to stick to the walls, this investigation steadily increases G-force exposure. Where are we? I lost my spot. There. Steadily exposes G-force exposure to test the outer boundaries of seedlings' perceptual abilities. As the arms of the centrifuge spin, scientists hope to pinpoint exactly where growth response begins. So I just learned that seedlings have perceptual abilities. Isn't that cool? And here's a nice picture of the doctor smiling with his mustard seedling as photosynthesis organisms. Plants are also very sensitive to light cues for growth. Using directed lights, plant gravity perception is providing additional growth cues at various points to test relationship between light perception and gravity perception. Back at home, botanists can watch the footage to assess responses. Even though the orbiting laboratory is, so what do I say, laboratory or laboratory? I'll say laboratory, is regularly resupplied, crew members must consume fresh deliveries quickly to supplement a large supply of shelf-stable foods. Space station investigators such as Veg-03 enable astronauts to act as gardeners and supplement their diets. So thank you for listening. You have been listening to Marco's AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. Again, I hope to get some astronomers on soon from NASA. Have a nice day. Bye. And like Mork used to say, nanu nanu.